agriculture, like most industries, appears to be growing in two directions. Very big or very small. Too small to benefit from economies of scale and too big to be adaptable, the medium-sized farm of our grandparents is unable to compete, and so is fading into history. This observation leads us to ask, which will survive into the future to feed our future, the very big or the very small?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 675th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Vancouver who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Michael.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello there.
Folks, it may seem strange to those of us living in the industrial West, but most of the world's food is produced on small, family-scale farms. There are many names for these farms. The good folks at Via Campesina call them peasant farms. I have taken to calling the ones that grow in or near a city metro farms. These small farms have many advantages in producing food for the competitive marketplace, including the ability to move and groove and to be adaptable, their proximity to consumers, and fresh-from-the-garden quality. In fact, a study conducted for the World Bank discovered that small farmers throughout the world are 400 to 1,400% more productive per acre than the giant farms of the Green Revolution, despite using few, if any, of the implements of modern technology. But big farms have the advantages of economies of scale. How do economies of scale work? If I have 1 acre and wish to buy a $10,000 tractor, that tractor will cost me $10,000 per acre. But if you have 1,000 acres and wish to buy that tractor, it will only cost you $10 per acre. Where economies of scale really benefit a competitor is in the purchasing of government influence. Follow along here. If I have 1 acre and wish to buy a congressperson's vote for $10,000, that vote will cost me $10,000 per acre. But if you have 1,000 acres and wish to buy the congressperson's vote, that vote will only cost you $10 per acre. Obviously, economies of scale put small farms at a great disadvantage when it comes to competing for government influence, and one can readily see the consequence in the policies governments adopt to manage farm policies. For example, the food safety legislation currently working its way through the U.S. Congress was written, for the most, by the very big to constrict competition from the small and very small. And so today we ask, which will survive into the future to feed our future, the very big or the very small? Today we have with us to help us find an answer to this question, Nettie Weeb, who is with the International Coordinating Committee for Via Campesina. Nettie, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hello.
How are things up? You're up there in Saskatchewan, Canada.
Yes, I am.
And you're
a farmer up here.
A farmer. You know that of the last three Food Chain episodes, two of them have been with Saskatchewan farmers.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, it's kind of neat. Of course, we had Bruno Saskatchewan farmer Percy Smizer on a couple episodes ago, and we're happy to have you, too. First of all, what on earth is Via Campesina?
Well, we're an international movement of small-scale farmers, family farmers, peasants, who gathered together in the face of that terrible threat to our livelihoods and to our communities and quite frankly, to your food and our food when agriculture was scooped up into the international trade negotiations in a big way through the GATT, now the WTO. And we realized that that kind of an export oriented agriculture would be the death of many of our small-scale producers as well as our communities.
When you say small-scale, you're kind of talking about the medium-sized farms that my grandparents had up there in Montana, right, where, you know, a family would have a couple hundred acres and grow food, whatever kind of commodity they were growing and send them to the co-op or whatnot. They're really disappeared. They have disappeared here in the United States. They're kind of disappearing around the world is what you're saying, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I'm talking about, and scale is, of course, a function of where you farm. Up
right.
here in Saskatchewan, where we've got short growing seasons and very cold winters, you have to have more ground for a family to live off the farm. But what we talk about when we talk about small scale is the kind of farm where the farm family is close to the land, works their own land, relies on their own investment, their own labor, and produces food for people and not commodities for a stock market.
Fair enough. Now, when you say campesina, what is the English translation of campesina?
It's peasant. And peasant in English we have a prejudice against that word.
We do, don't we?
Think that peasant means backwards somehow. But in actual fact, it means people of the land, people who are close to the land, who live by working the land.
And we do have a prejudice against the word. We think of it in terms of somebody who's very low class and beneath our dignity or something like that. Or at least that's what the connotations are in modern...
Yeah, it's sort of fallen into that. It's gotten that that bad reputation from a kind of commentary that says whatever is urban is better than what's rural, whatever is industrialized is better than what's organic, whatever is corporatized is better than what is the labor of people's hands, and somehow we've aggrandized the view that the further we are from our food, the more sophisticated we are, and I think that's a huge mistake.
Back ass words, as it were.
Indeed.
So we always ask, Nettie, who pays the way? So how does Via Campesina earn its way in the world?
Well, we're volunteers.
You don't get any money from Monsanto, I take it.
We do not. I say that with no regret whatsoever.
All right.
No, we rely on ourselves and our organizations. The Farmers Union here is entirely voluntary based, voluntary fees, membership mm-hmm. fees, and then there have been some generous foundations and. Who have periodically helped us gather in some events.
Fair enough.
We pay our own way.
Fair enough. Here in the industrial West, most of us think food comes from a supermarket, and some of us are even quite surprised when we learn that milk comes from a cow, and we have grown that far from our food. But most of the world's food is not industrialized food yet. It still comes from peasants. Could you give us a thumbnail of that phenomenon, where the world's food really comes from?
Well, for the most part, you're right. For the most part, people eat food that's grown in their own neighborhoods, in their own communities. About three-quarters of the food in the world is...
Three-quarters.
It depends on which study you look at, but anywhere from 75 to 85, 90% of the food that's eaten in the world. Just remember here that the dense populations in Africa and Asia, for the most part, are still have high percentages of peasants and live in rural villages and eat what's grown in those places. North America and Europe, the highly industrialized world, misleads us, because when we push our grocery cart down the supermarket aisle, if that's where we're shopping, very little of what you see is in fact grown anywhere near you. Most of what's on your plate is comes from thousands of miles away. But that's the exception in terms of actual population, feeding actual populations, which is one of the things, one of the myths I always try to bust, which is that somehow we can't feed the world unless we continue to corporatize and concentrate.
And that's where we're going to head. We're going to have to take a quick break. But what you say, in essence, is that we in the industrialized West are really an aberration when it comes to what we eat.
Not only an aberration, but a danger.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're looking into the future, and we're going to try to figure out who is going to feed us in the future. Will it be the big, huge, giant farms of industrial agriculture with their industrial foods, or will it be the peasants or the people of the earth, the you and I's of the world, who are growing food for each other? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Nettie Weeb.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Which will survive the competition in the marketplace to feed our future? Will it be the industrial farms of corporate agriculture, or will it be the small farms, the family-scale farms of you and I? Well, as we have heard right before the break, Nettie Weeb of Via Campesina laid down an interesting statistic. Whereas those of us who live in the West might think that food comes from thousands of miles away because that's where it comes to us, most of the world, 75 to 90% of the world's food comes from people in the neighborhood or growing it for each other. That's an incredible statistic and one that's hard to comprehend for those of us who grew up in the West. Can the peasant agriculture of the world feed the world, Nettie Weeb?
Not only can it, but it must. The industrial food system, export-oriented food system that corporations and, as you rightly said in your introduction, acquiescing governments have put in place is unsustainable in many ways. It's unsustainable in that it relies on non-renewable fuels, and insofar it's trying to cope with that by growing agrofuels, it's doing another whole layer of damage. So it's unsustainable. It's unsustainable in its water use. I mean, something like 70% of the fresh water supply is being used by agriculture, and much of it in the industrial agriculture production in intensive livestock operations.
Right.
Much of it is released as polluted and almost unusable water then.
Let me throw
far too hard on our biosystems, and it's far too and it's relying on unrenewable fuels, and it's emitting far too much greenhouse gas. It's a danger in terms of climate. So in many ways, it is unsustainable in the long term.
Let me throw something out. It seems to me like both could work together. It seems to me like industrial agriculture could produce those raw commodities for making manufactured food. But local agriculture or peasant agriculture or metropolitan agriculture could produce the fresh and the color and the taste and everything else that we need. It seems to me that the very, very big and the very, very small could work together. Any possibility of that in your mind?
There's always the hope that somehow the mouse will dance quickly enough around the feet of the elephant that he won't get crushed. And we're all on the side of the little mouse.
I think you're right.
Let's be realistic. Actually, our experience in North America and Europe, but particularly in North America, is that the mouse cannot, in the long term, dance fast enough, particularly if the elephant is on chemical steroids and has a regulatory system that says he can stomp all over the field.
Okay, let's go to the phone.
It's not fenced in.
Not fenced in.
Let's
go to the phone and talk with Brock. Brock, welcome to the food chain. Which food would you think will feed our future?
Neither.
Neither. Good.
Yeah, American agriculture, I'm a historian and an economist, grew up on private property cooperative, where many small farmers would then deal with the economy of scale and
yes,
get together
right.
silos, tractors, railheads, so that a quantity of food could be grown not only with diversity, but if they all wanted to grow the same crop due to the environmental reasons in the area, they could.
Mm-hmm.
And then all this big is bad and small is beautiful and small is bad and big is beautiful is kind of silly because historically, up until the advent of the installment payment, hurt American agriculture and medical care and education.
You mean debt, right? You're talking about debt.
Debt in the form of a rigid fixed amount. Somebody's going to look on an amortization table and a crystal
right.
ball and tell you 5 years from now you're going to be able to pay $2,482.50 for something.
Mm-hmm.
That's mysticism. What American agriculture was built on and got away from, where 97% of us lived on farms and only 3% lived in the cities, to the flip-flop situation of 3% in the cities and 97% in the cities and only 3% on the farms, was tools. And the way that tools were purchased and many
money.
Other things was with, dig this, a percentage of income.
Right.
Whether you're a farmer, a poor farmer and you broke a leg, or a rich farmer and you broke a leg, the country doctor would take care of absolutely everybody in the free market by saying, that's 2 chickens for you and that's 20 chickens for you. It's the same price to him at his time and so forth, but it's the real economic value of the broken leg to the farmer. The same went for farm tools and many other things.
So what you're saying is that we went to a cash economy.
We went to a combination of fee-for-service,
mm-hmm.
and we got away from the concept of insurance. Also, there's natural disasters. Weather is unpredictable.
Right.
So it makes no sense at all to have a fixed, rigid amount in the face of uncertainty. So you base your financial system on uncertainty, then you win, small and large and medium.
Let's have Nettie, who is a farmer. How would you respond to that, Nettie?
Well, of course, the piece you name about the debt and the debt being hooked to standardized repayment schedules, which in fact are not hooked to weather patterns, but the income being hooked to weather patterns, is of course absolutely true. But can I just go back to an earlier piece that you named there of co-ops, and that cooperatives in some ways initially, and that's certainly the case here in Canada, to initially responded in a collective way to the pressure
a
for economies of
way.
Scale.
Collective
yeah.
has a tendency to go for that power he was talking about before. And it would be clearer to an audience if you stayed away from collectivism and talked about cooperative.
In a cooperative way. Well, let's stay with that language because that's actually how we named our cooperatives.
Right.
And with that tremendous pressure on economies of scale and standardization and a policy regime that actually fostered corporate takeover, actually most of the co-ops, the agricultural cooperatives here in Canada, as in the States, have had to, or by decision, have collapsed and moved into a stock options privatization corporate mode also. So that doesn't seem, on the face of it,
hey, how is a corporation different
anymore?
But you're still looking at each of the original farmers with their stake in the land and time committed being part of that corporation.
Yeah, so how is a corporation? How is a corporation different than a co-op?
The co-op generally has a number of votes. Even old established things back in the 1880s, like the Greens, you had a number of votes by the sort of a formula by the amount of acreage you had and the value of the crop and so forth was sort of figured out.
Right.
None of the incentives for what we think of as modern nutrition were there. It was mostly bulk, and to this day is still bulk measurements of things. Only recently is marketing gotten into
that. But the co-op movement was actually not only economic but also a political movement that one member had one vote, and it wasn't actually tied to the size of your operation so much as in terms of its organizational structure as the respect for one member, one vote, which in some ways equalized
We have to take a quick break.
Brock,
can you hang on with us?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to hold on. And when we come back, we'll pick up this. What I'd like to go into when we get back is the role government plays in the direction of agriculture.
Because there's your evil force. But
we'll pick that up when we get back with Brock and with Nettie. And you, phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're looking into the future of our agriculture, and we're asking a real simple question. What kind of farm will survive the competition in the marketplace to produce food that you and I and our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren will eat? Will it be the big farms of industrial agriculture or the small farms of the peasants? Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, somewhere in the neighborhood of 75% of the world's food is produced by peasants, which means people who are close to the land. Will those farmers survive to produce food into our future? Or will they succumb to the competition of the industrialized food systems of the West? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. It is your food chain, after all. Well, let me ask you, Brock, do you think the very big and the very small can work together?
Yes, if all of them abandon the idea that they need government guns to enforce their particular model.
Well, wait a minute. Now, the odds of that are very slim, and here's why I think that to be so.
I'll oppose you after I hear you.
Okay, you got a deal. I believe that food is the most efficient way to control populations.
True.
Okay.
Or reduce
populations, or do whatever you want with the populations.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you can see food being used as a way of controlling people throughout history. So you think about it, and what kind of population does government want? Does government want a population of independent people who are living on the land and who owe nothing to anybody because they can grow their own food and sell it and earn a living? Or do they want a population of people who are confined to concrete blocks and cities where they're fed industrial foods and watch TV all day?
Both. Russell Means, who's been the past president of the World Congress of Indigenous People, not only defends private property, but there's economists like Hernandez Soto at the Milton Friedman Prize, $500,000, for advocating that the poor people of the world who have been squatting on land for 400 years in their family actually get a piece of paper that says, "This land is mine." Which means then they can collateralize it against farm tools or bakeries or whatever you want to do with it as a debt mechanism. Again, I favor a percentage of income. But his assertion is that the entire world would be 500% wealthier within a year if title companies, title insurance companies, and if you would, government recorders of such, implemented this. So you'd in
Let me
many
just, can I interrupt
in
here and just ask how has that worked
too.
In the States with the private property, the ownership, the title to land? How has that worked for small-scale farmers there?
Where has it worked? Has it worked anywhere?
Yeah.
Where the fascist aristocrats don't use the government military, like they're pushing 90,000 people out of Guatemala right now into Mexico. Mexico's got a southern immigrant problem.
How has it worked in Montana?
Mormons or Protestants or Jehovah's Witnesses, and their title to their land was a Catholic veto. So some big growers of tomatoes and tobacco plants are using the government military to push them off the land.
Let me ask you both of you this. It seems as though the government is going to play a deciding role on which side of this equation is going to win the future. And it seems like each side has an advantage. The peasant side has votes.
Right.
But the industrial side has the money.
Right.
And I don't know. You know, to me, I think the government is looking to have a population of docile people living in concrete blocks. I don't think the government wants a population of independent, free people. And I think...
Some do, some
I would
know.
Have to...
All right, Nettie, let's start with you.
All right, well, I it seems to me that in a democracy like you and I live in democracies, in some ways the government should be made to reflect what... and can be made to reflect what people actually want done. The problem in both of our democracies is that... once they're elected, there is, in fact, a tremendous lobbying pressure that can be exerted by the corporate sector.
Because they have the economies of scale. Yeah, because they have the economies of scale.
To, in fact, shape the regulations and the economic environment in favor of themselves. And actually, the free trade agreements allowed that pressure to mount on small-scale agriculture globally, not just in Canada and the U.S.,
oddly
but
enough,
everywhere.
Okay,
a lot of little drips make a big splash.
Go ahead.
A seventh grader of mine at one time came up with the idea of taking the water from seven flooding East Texas rivers and bringing it west to Sonora so 80% of the population could return into the Navajo Nation. The Navajos have $6 billion worth of uranium and coal in the ground they can't do anything with because they don't have any water, and they can't use their good mineral-rich soil to farm because they don't have any water. So the idea was, well, let's trade around with those people's water pipes and see which railroad is interested. I just sent off a proposal on her behalf to Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railways to see if they would be interested in it.
In hauling water?
And not hauling, but having an aqueduct underneath their railroad tracks and bringing this destructive water that kills 150 Texans each year, wipes out a few towns, because the railroad tracks on dirt don't make very good dams, you know.
So
the large-scale thinking with a lot of small people benefiting, as you say, can work together. And this can be entirely done without government.
Well, do you think...
But occasionally they get in the way, and in Texas, he made a law that said you can move Texas water anywhere you want in Texas, but that doesn't mean New Mexico or Sonora.
All right, Brock, one quick question. What kind of citizens do you think government wants? Do you think government...
Depends on what your government is. I have an evil fascist cousin named Etienne Davignon, who is the vice chancellor of the European Union and for 4 years has been the host of the Bilderberger Group, and they seem to actually want to reduce population and would begin to play into the political hands of the smallest beautiful group, while they might be doing destructive major agriculture. And there are agendas that there are bad guys out there. But the good guys can fight back both with numbers and doing economics and business in farming a lot smarter. Because the more people that you have making it and staying on their farm instead of getting their farm tools repossessed on a bank's parking lot or their farm repossessed, Willie Nelson can't understand why he's still doing Farm Aid concerts after 20 years, you know?
Right.
There's got to be a better financial alternative than rigid fixed payments.
Well, okay, Brock, thank you for the comment. We're going to have to move on, but thank you very much for jumping in today. Really appreciate it. Folks, the phone number's today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Let's talk with Scott. Scott, welcome to the food chain.
Thank
You've
you,
got Nettie Wiebe and Michael Olson. Go ahead.
Great show. Obviously, our survival depends on how we shop for food. I think once people are educated the ugly truth of the agro-conglomerate beast, they'll return to the new agrarian society. They'll return to the earth, to the peasants. You know, so I think we should pass out the movie Food, Inc. in front of Safeways, et cetera. Michael, the question I have is, how do we get there from here?
You know, can you hold on to that? We're going to have to take a quick break.
Sir.
Can you stick with me for a minute? Okay, stick with Nettie Wiebe and Michael Olson on the food chain. We're talking the food of our future. Who's going to grow it for us? Is it going to be the giant corporate industrial model, or is it going to be the little person, the peasant, the metropolitan farmer? What do you think? What role will government play in this decision-making process? What kind of citizen do you think the government wants us to be? Do you think it wants a population of independent people who can take care of themselves? Or do you think it wants a population of dependent people who need the government to survive? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Well, there is a precedent for government deciding what kind of farm would feed the future of its country, and that was the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union had decided that it was going to have very big farms, so it took all the little farmers and dumped them into big farms. And the nation starved itself into oblivion. Essentially, the large farms, the large collectivized farms, were unable to feed the population of Russia, and so Russia had to fall back on the peasant farms of the metropolitan areas. And those farmers' markets that served the cities were really what kept the nation alive, and it was the peasants that managed to do that. I fear that perhaps our governments are coming of mind that they would like to see the farms of the future become these giant industrial models, because they would be much easier to control and to deal with than a whole bunch of small independent farmers who are earning their keep by producing food. I fear that, but maybe I'm wrong. Nettie Wiebe, am I off base there?
Well, I'm not going to in any way impugn the motives of your government there, but the corporate sector has gotten very, very much control over our food system. But let me just say something positive here. I've always said that real environmentalism begins at the breakfast table, and I think as more and more people begin to see that the way they eat and the way they shop food is in fact has the biggest environmental impact on the way they're living, that their food shopping is a huge place where they can make a good contribution rather than a negative one. And you're seeing, and you've said that yourself, that there's a lot of gardening and food production going on right around and in urban areas. And I read a statistic here recently that surprised me, but I think is well-grounded, that about 25% of food is grown in and around urban centers. It's really urban agriculture. And as a farmer, I find that hard to believe because we're so productive out there in the rural areas. But it tells me that people are more and more engaged in their own food production. And whether we're moving towards small-scale farming again, which I think we are, nevertheless, it's very, very important, I think, for urban people to get reconnected to how food is produced and what the meaning of food is in their lives. Partly what's the cultural loss as well as the agricultural loss in this corporatization, export-oriented commodification, industrialization, however you describe this food system we're in. Part of the real loss is the loss of the meaning of food in people's lives. The food has suddenly become more and more just like a parallel to fuel in our gas tanks.
A box of Grey Goo.
Yeah, it no longer has that sort of deeper cultural meaning for our communities and how we're connected to each other and to the places where we live in. And I think recapturing that meaning, that culture of food, is in fact a very important component of recapturing control over our food system.
Well, Scott, did Nettie answer your question of where do we go from here?
Well, clearly the people's will is Metro Farms, and the role of the government in a representative democracy is to represent the people's will. But the government has shut off our water to the Great Valley. The government, you mentioned the Soviet Union, Michael, the first planned famine in modern history was when Stalin ordered, centralized government ordered the planting of corn, which never grew, and so everyone had to depend on the government. So, God help us.
Thank you for the call, Scott. Let's go to Rory. Rory, I have to ask you, can the very, very big and the very, very small just get along?
I believe so. And I think, thanks for taking my call, by the way.
You bet.
I think I was really intrigued by what Brock was having to say, and maybe you could have him call in and bring him in as a guest. Nothing against
him. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, that was good stuff. I mean, I don't often think about the macroeconomic dynamics, but we need to. The thing is, with your guest, you know, there's a tendency to paint, you know, corporations and corporate farming is big and bad and mean. And, you know, I work for a company that is a corporation. It's a small family-owned corporation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's making great strides in strawberry cultivar developments mm-hmm. that have application all over the world for big and small farmers, cooperatives in Europe and small, large farmers here in the States.
You know, and you're exactly what I was thinking about when I was thinking that, you know, it seems like the two worlds are kind of complement each other. You know, the big have the capability of providing, you know, the big commodities, and the little could fill in everything else where the big just can. It's just, but...
And I'm like you, Michael. I like locally grown fresh. I mean, I grow a garden every year, have since I was a kid. And there's room for that. And there's the reason 25% of the produce is produced in around urban areas is because people can make a living at it. Because people in the cities are clamoring and craving that
for real food. Yeah.
I mean, that's what Metro Farm's about.
Yeah.
And there's no way that we're going to reverse the percentages of people that are living in urban and cities going back to the farms. I mean, there may be some shift back, but most people aren't going to want to do it. Most people don't love the soil. They don't want to get dirt.
Too much work, yeah. Roy, thank you very much for the call. Really appreciate it. Folks, we'll be right back with Nettie Weave and you. Phone lines are completely full up. What are we going to do? Right back. Welcome back. Michael Olson here with Nettie Weeb, who is with the International Organizing Committee of Via Campesina, an organization that pulls together peasant farming organizations all around the world into one unit so that people can talk to each other. And there are a lot of peasant farmers around the world, aren't there, Nettie?
Yes. Oh, yes. In many countries... rural people still outnumber urban people. It's in the industrialized world where we've become such a small sort of rump population
right.
of the main population. But I'm very optimistic that we will reverse that. I just want to respond to the last question around the sort of pessimism, oh, you're not going to get people to leave the cities and go back out into the country. As a matter of fact, there are lots of people, and that's here in Canada as in the States, who long to live closer to the land. In fact, wealthy people very often and this is a problem for agriculture, take very good agricultural land and turn them into acreages because they want to live out in the country. So I'm not nearly so pessimistic about reawakening and not going back, but going forward into
agriculture, Nadia,
which is much more resilient and much healthier, and which has many people working in it.
I also think that the reverse is true. I think cities have to welcome agriculture back to survive. Let's go quickly to Ron. Ron, calling in from San Francisco. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Hello. I want to just shift to what Via Compostina is about, which is a relationship to nature, which is different than corporations. It's not just producing food. You have here what the Compostinas want to do is not only own their land, but produce healthy food, which is ecological. And that makes a big difference. That means it's a social movement. In a cultural one, it's not just producing lots of bad food for people to eat in the cities. I mean, they want to live on the land. That means the families can live on the land. That means no pesticides, no herbicides.
Ron, let me ask you this, Ron. Do you think that there's a room in the world for both the very big and the very small?
No, I don't think that. I think that's one of those notions. Yes, we're going to be on the middle of the road. The corporations are destroying people's health. They produce processed food, which is full of poisons every day. And the lie about essentially producing good food for everybody who are hungry. This is the failed policy in Africa.
Africans
have to produce their own food, not get from ConAgra and the U.S. This is all bad way of doing it. The campesinos know exactly what to do, which is your local farm producing good food for healthy people in their own places. And they have to stop WTO. This is a much more interesting and much more culturally advanced way of understanding how to produce healthy food.
Okay, Ron, thank you very much for the call. We're running out of time. Nettie, thank you so much for joining us today.
I just want to thank Ron. I think that's entirely right. It's not just about a commodity. Food is us. And
that's what you were talking about. It's culture. It's everything. It's health. It's everything. Food is everything. And if we think we can get everything in a box of processed stuff with gray goo in it, then we're in deep doo-doo. That's what I think. And we
will not survive it. So this is our survival. This is our resilience to go to a kind of food production which isn't corporatized, which takes control back for people and works with nature.
Do you think it's possible for the very big and the very small to get along?
I think the very big squeeze out the very small. You can see
there it is.
With the GMOs, pollution, with
Nettie,
the water.
Thank you very much. We're out of time. We really appreciate all tuning in. Tune in next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
You bet.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.